can't we all just get along? A simple yet complicated question as society deals with diversity and now the hot button issue of teaching critical race theory. I'm David James, and next on 2 Main Street, my guest, Dr. Rob Shelby, Chief Diversity Officer at the University of Evansville, will help us understand what divides us and what unites us. Rob Shelby not only talks the talk, he walks the walk, being a black man married to a white woman with biracial children. His personal experiences give him plenty of credibility when he visits companies and organizations, listening as much as lecturing about the need for more diversity training. 2 Main Street is next, presented by Jeffrey Berger of Berger Wealth Services at Baird Private Wealth Management. From the WNIN Tri-State Public Media Center in downtown Evansville, I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street. Well, the only time we should separate colors is when doing the laundry. An inspiring quote making the rounds on social media, a logical, sensible commentary, but some stains are stubborn and tough to remove. Now that we're turning the corner on the pandemic, well, hopefully we have this Delta variant now, seems there is a heightened focus on diversity. It's certainly not a new issue, just one that's been simmering and occasionally flaring up. A reoccurring riddle in a land where all men and women are supposedly created equal. Now there's debate, and more correctly, confusion over critical race theory. Sides are being drawn and the wagons are being circled. My guest is here to help us make sense of it all. Dr. Rob Shelby is a sociologist, educator, director of the Diversity Center at the University of Evansville. Dr. Shelby, welcome to 2 Main Street. Good to have you here. And you were here a few weeks ago for our diversity training. And I just want to get your rating. How are we as an audience?
Well, thank you for having me here. It was fantastic to be with you all. So, yeah, it was great. And you were my first live audience in several months. So that was fantastic. Yeah.
Well, that's kind of neat, though.
Yes.
And get the reaction. And
yes.
So what's the bottom line of these training sessions?
So the whole point is to really level set folks, right? So that to help them understand what are we talking about when we're talking about diversity training. And really what I would really put a finer point on it is cultural diversity training, because every human being has culture. They were raised and trained and what we usually say is socialized into our society or into the society in which they're a part of. And we just need to recognize what that means as we're trying to live and work together. And so those trainings that we put together and work with various organizations to help them kind of work through those challenges is exactly that, acknowledging that we all have culture. And then because we then are a multicultural organization or a country, then how should we be interacting with each other? What does that look like for us? And so that's the whole point and baseline of that of the training.
So let's start with some definitions.
Sure.
Diversity.
That's a big one, right?
It's not just race, it's disabilities, it's right. Background.
Yes, and what I'll say there too, we're talking about social diversity, and another word that tends to get used is variability. So if we're talking about, most people recognize that humanity, that there's lots of differences amongst us as a species, right? We're still a part of humanity, and yet there are things that are different. And because of those differences, that's what we then talk about in this large bucket we call diversity. So, yes, we're talking about it is certainly race and ethnicity. And I tend to say that one is the most identifiable.
Sure.
At least we think it is, right? We think mm-hmm. we can look externally at a person and determine if they are what racial or ethnic group they belong to. And we're often wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But it also includes religion. It includes socioeconomic status. Sexual identity, mm-hmm. gender identity, mm-hmm. sexual orientation, gender itself. It also includes age. It includes many of the categories that get used that our government has, we call them protected classes. We're not supposed to discriminate against these groups. And mm-hmm. so that's how we use that. It's broadly conceived, and then we want to try to find the best way to help all people within those categories.
Now, under this giant umbrella that we've just talked about, there's this new term now. I don't know if it's, well, it's a new term, critical race theory.
Yes.
And we already said it has an acronym now, CRT.
Yes, so CRT's been around for a lot longer than people realize. It really surfaced as a real theory trying to address concrete social problems around 1989 or so. Because the tenets of critical race theory, though, have been around since the 1800s, so and into the 1900s. So one of the early thinkers was W.E.B. Du Bois, our first African-American sociologist who earned a Ph.D. His focus was trying to understand the role and the experience of black people, African-Americans, in a white-dominant American society. That then allowed him to then branch beyond that. He was a pan-Africanist, so he was concerned about the impact on black people around the world. So CRT has this sociological and Marxist connection to it, because a lot of what we're talking about here is the difference between those groups that are in positions of power, wealth, and prestige, and those who are not. So it makes its way into critical race theory, specifically as it's being applied to law around 1989, 1990. And what's happening there is that we certainly see that race is a primary challenge for our American society. And the place where it reveals itself the most is in our criminal justice and legal system. And so it's here that you start to see legal theorists really kind of take this critical race theoretical set of ideas and really give it shape, give it more concrete meaning as it relates to law in particular. And okay. So here we see it popping up in many more areas now.
We're going to delve deeper into that later on in the program. But First, we want to learn more about you,
sure,
Rob Shelby. Now, you have quite a perspective on seeing the world, and I don't know if technicolor is the right word or not. Black man married to a white woman.
Mm-hmm.
You have biracial children. And so you have a pretty good view of what's going on then, I think, in society.
Well, you know, that's part of the reason why I got involved in sociology. I mean, I recognize that the way that I was raised to respect and love all people as kind of a core of our family identity. And this often surprises people, but yes, African-American, really rooted in the African-American community growing up as a child, but I really grew up in a Jewish community. And so recognizing that there were a lot of similarities and a lot of distinctions, and I never attempted to wash away those distinctions because they're so important to our identity. So obviously as I got older, and I joined the military right after high school and traveled around the world, and I was always drawn to the group that we call the marginalized, so the people who are kind of on the fringe of those mm-hmm. societies. And I was often concerned about how they were being treated. And, you know, being a part of the military in foreign countries, you start to learn things about these societies, these cultures, and how they do things. And this is before I was a sociologist. I was really keyed in on this. And so I came back from being in the military and started my formal educational training, so to speak.
So why were you attracted to the military then?
Okay, so here's the real deal. I was a horrible high school student. And my parents made it very clear, son, if you want to go to college, you're going to have to figure that out on your own, because we're not going to pay for you to go there and fail. I was not hurt by that. I think that was an accurate assessment of who I was at the time. I would say I was a late bloomer. And one of the things that I really learned as a child was about discipline. And so the military became the thing for me. I should mention my sister, one of my sisters who's 4 years older than me, went in before I did. And so I really paid attention to how she was changing, what she was learning. She often shared her experiences with me. And so I knew that was what I wanted to do. It was something that I could call my own. I wanted to serve our country. And I thought that was the best way for me to do it. And it would really give me some skills and give me some confidence, because I really didn't have it as a young person.
Which branch did you go into?
I was in the Army. Yeah, for 4 years.
And you served overseas?
I did. I was in Germany for 2 years and came back to the United States and I was stationed at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. So anybody who knows about Fort Bragg, so a rapid deployment post. And then was in the Middle East for over a year, serving during Desert Storm.
Mm-hmm. What about that experience?
So you know how I mentioned that I tend to pay attention to those people who are on the fringe.
Sure.
And, you know, I arrived in country, to be honest with you, I thought that I was in Arizona. I said, they just flew us around for several hours and then just let us out in the desert. The heat met us immediately. And I thought, oh, this is not real. It felt very surreal. But I recognized a group of people who were really marginalized in that society. So Indonesians are used in large part to do a lot of the dirtier jobs, the menial labor. And one of the things that we did at that time is we really moved into country and we took over a civil workers camp and displaced the Indonesians who were working and living in that location. And so I was often interacting with them and they loved to practice their English, which was really mm-hmm. fun. But I recognized that there was some real, there was a social hierarchy within a country that was not my home country. And boy, that grabbed my attention. And so I really wanted to make sure that I was not doing more damage by having and building relationships with the people who lived in the country of Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and then into Iraq.
So wearing a uniform, you also didn't want to be an ugly American then.
Correct, yes. And I learned that lesson in Germany. For any soldier who goes to or airman or Marine Corps that goes to any foreign country, it's really important for us to recognize who we are and how we fit within those receiving countries. So when I was in Germany, I actually lived in a very small rural community, so up in the mountains. And so being a part of a smaller community, you really have to recognize your impact. And so, you know, as a young person, I was 19 years old at the time because I went in when I was 17. I was already keying in on that. And so very cognizant of the fact that having my own cultural identity and background has an impact on the people around me.
Okay. Now, you said you're one of seven children?
I am.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in a city just north of Chicago called Evanston, Illinois. And so pretty close to, you know, Evanston and Evansville.
You get that. People get that mixed up occasionally.
Sure,
people
yeah.
say, oh, you're from northern Illinois. No, from Evansville, not
yes.
Evanston.
Okay. Yes.
So you've gone through that.
I have.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So what was that like in Evanston?
Well, so I'm originally from South Carolina. I was born in a small town in South Carolina called Greer. And that's where my mom's side of the family is from, mm-hmm. and many still live down in that area. And
the Low Country?
The Low Country. That's okay. Exactly what it is, yes, or what we tend to call the Bottoms. Yes.
Okay.
yes. And but, you know, about 4 or 5 years old, we moved back or moved north. My parents were intent on having a house for us to grow up in. And so my dad moved to Evanston first. End up working two jobs, secured a loan at a very challenging time in American history for black families to secure bank loans. And there's a fun story behind that, and maybe we can talk off air about that. It's very fun.
We can talk on air about it.
Oh, sure. So, yeah, it's a fantastic story. So, you
okay.
know, my dad, he came to Evanston really sight unseen, didn't know much about the Chicagoland area. And he starts working for a landscaping company, or a nursery that had a landscaping part to it. And the owners hired him and full-time. And he mentioned to them that he had seven children, and his wife had given him an ultimatum that he needs to find a house for us to live in. And they said, so what are the challenges you're facing? And he said, well, I can't get a loan. So it wasn't even an hour. They came back to my dad and said, gave him a piece of paper, told him to go to a bank that they had identified and said, talk to this person. We have co-signed for your loan. Because my dad, if you know about redlining and things like that, so he was given a loan, a 30-year fixed mortgage loan to purchase a home in Evanston, Illinois, and was thrilled to tell my mom, and we moved to Evanston, and And then he and his best friend then remodeled the house so there was space. What, there were all seven of us at home at the time. Mm-hmm. So, but space for us to be able to live. And my dad would tell me that story because he said, you know, son, you need to recognize that, yeah, there's a lot of problems in our country. And there's a lot of problems between people in our country. But there are some people who are willing to put their name on the line for you. And so he was really intent on making sure that whatever debts he had, he paid, and he paid them on time. And so he went on to tell me about how he paid his loans, that house home loan on time, paid the house off, got some equity, and then that kind of creates this cycle of wealth is the way that he was working on that.
Well, you had some great role models, it sounds like, growing up.
I really did.
Okay, now, your wife, Tricia.
Yes.
Where did you meet Tricia?
That Jewish community that I grew up right next to. So Evanston is right next to a community called Skokie.
Oh, yes.
Which was a real Jewish enclave, especially during the time I was growing up.
That's where they had the Nazi march through Skokie, right?
That is right, yes. And it usually causes quite a challenge for the community. But a very diverse community now as well. There is a Sikh community that's there and a Muslim community that's growing and strong there as well. So Tricia is from central Illinois, and sight unseen became an au pair or a live-in nanny for a family in Skokie. And I met her through my best friend. So I had just gotten out of the Army and came back home to live with my parents. They were still in Evanston. And my best friend said, hey, you want to meet this friend of mine? And I reluctantly said yes. And the real story is she did not like me when she first met me. and so that was a real honest assessment. I was a jerk, to be honest with you.
Well, how did you woo her finally?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if I really did. I think what happened is, as she says, she saw there was much more to me than this gruff exterior I was trying to portray. She saw the real me.
She could mold you.
Yes, yes, yes.
I hear that a lot.
Yes, yes. She's done a fine job, I think.
Now, you have children.
Yes, yes. Three daughters. I say when I talk about my kids, they're all adult aged, which means they have met the legal requirement for what it means to be an adult. And yes, but they're fantastic kids. And my middle daughter just had her first child. So our second grandchild was born.
Congratulations.
Yes. So we were just back up in the Chicagoland area this past weekend.
Now, you have had several different careers, I understand.
Oh, gosh, yes.
So you finally found your calling, I guess.
Well,
after a while.
Well, we'll say I have found a place to apply my calling. Here's what this is what I learned early in life. Life is about gaining experience, right? It's mm-hmm. it's about learning and meeting people. And here it is again. This is why I think I got into sociology. I could work anywhere, and as long as I could do that, geography was no limitation. I'm very grateful because my wife, Tricia, is the same way. So this is why we've moved so many times, and we've met so many people and had so many different experiences. Right out of the Army, I was a field engineer for a telecommunications firm and worked for GE for several years. And I had a technical background, so it's not like I just woke up and that was something I started doing. And I did that for 13 years and really enjoyed it. Along the way, though, I started to recognize that I enjoyed working with people more than I working with gadgets and, mm-hmm. and tinkering with things. And so I decided I need to start figuring that out because the real complexity in life is trying to figure out people. I couldn't really figure myself out, to be honest with you. And so I was on this quest to really understand people. And it was during that whole part that I then moved into my pastoral career. I went to a small liberal arts college just north of Chicago. And
name, please?
Trinity International University.
Okay.
And I majored in biblical studies and youth ministry and worked for local churches in my community, working with young people and their families.
And so you were an older student going to?
Yes. I was a non-traditional student in a very traditional institution. But here's the thing. I was still working as an engineer, and I remember talking to my boss about this kind of transition I was in, and he said, you know, Rob, we can work around your schedule, whatever your class schedule is. And I said, you realize that the schooling I'm doing is not going to benefit me as an engineer. He goes, it doesn't matter. is going to benefit you. It's going to benefit us because you're here and you're working with people. And let's just see where this goes. And it was through that process that I really started to figure out that I was making the right choice. And so as I finished my undergraduate degree, started working for a church full time as a family and youth pastor, it was quite the transition for me. Let me just say it that way. So that's just two careers, right?
Right.
So the other part was I did that for several years and then went on to get my master's degree at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, which was connected to my undergraduate alma mater. And I started there as a Master of Divinity student, looking to be an ordained minister, and got about two and a half years into that program, and then my wife was diagnosed with cancer. And so I had to make some choices. And I decided to stop my education and really focus on caring for her and our kids at the time. And so it was one of those markers in my life where it came at a very important time because I was really feeling that program was not the best fit for me.
How long a period was that for her recovery?
So her recovery, it was pretty staggering. So she was stage 3 breast cancer. It was in her lymph nodes.
Oh, my.
And so we're talking aggressive chemotherapy and radiation after she had surgery. And, we learned along the way that, the side effects for the medication, about 1% have really adverse side effects, and she fell into that 1%. Really challenging. And she has been, so she had breast cancer. And then since we've been here in Evansville, she's had kidney cancer. But as we like to say in our family, cancer can't knock her down. She gives cancer the kick, right? So she is such a resilient person. And I've learned so much from her over the course of our, 28 years of marriage. So,
well, your divinity training, did that help you through this crisis?
Oh, certainly, certainly. It's one thing to talk about things, about working through hard times. It's something completely different when you're living it. And so, I struggled in my faith. I call it a crisis of faith, and I've had several of them over the course of my life. And the real questions of, so if I'm quote unquote doing the things I'm supposed to be doing, if I'm living my life rightly, why is it that I'm suffering? And I think that's a fundamental question that most human beings ask anyway. Like, why is there suffering in the world? Remember, we talked about that in our training, right?
Mm-hmm.
And every culture tries to make sense of that. And my faith really, really gave me a strong sense of understanding why we suffer. And it doesn't mean that you've necessarily done anything wrong. It is a part of the human condition, but it's how you work through the suffering that really matters, right? And so I was really intent on making sure that the experiences of loss and I don't know if you've ever had this experience, David, where you're in this perpetual state of thinking that the people or the person that you love most dearly is going to leave you, and not by their choice. It's outside of our control. And then trying to help our children understand what that dynamic would be like. If it wasn't for my faith, I'm telling you, I would not be the person I am today.
We're talking to Dr. Rob Shelby. He's the Chief Diversity Officer at the University of Evansville. We're going to talk about this hot topic that is facing educators these days, teaching critical race theory. I know you're an educator at U of E. What is everybody fired up about this thing? And we're going to learn about your life on the family farm, Rob. I understand you have some critters there, an aviary?
I used to, yep.
Oh, a beekeeper? Mm-hmm. Wow,
yes.
That's
mm-hmm.
amazing. I'm David James. This is 2 Main Street, presented by Jeffrey Berger, Berger Wealth Services at Bayard Private Wealth Management. I hope you're enjoying this conversation. I certainly am. We'll be right back. Dr. Shelby mentioned the influential sociologist W.E.B. Du Bois, who was co-founder of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP. Here are more historical facts. In 1895, Du Bois became the first African-American to earn a Ph.D. from Harvard University. He later studied in Germany with some of the prominent social scientists of his day. William Edward Burkhardt Du Bois was born in 1868 in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. He died one day before Martin Luther King Jr. delivered his I Have a Dream speech at the March on Washington in 1963. W.E.B. Du Bois was 95 years old. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James. My guest is Dr. Rob Shelby, Chief Diversity Officer at the University of Evansville. Now let's go back to critical race theory, teaching it. Wow. Hot button issue. Critics claim it's political to extreme. Supporters say it's needed to fill in the gaps in our history. Footnotes of U.S. history often overlooked that paint a negative picture of American democracy. Rob, as a sociologist, what's your take on critical race theory? Should it be taught in schools?
My short answer is yes. And the reason is that it is a lens by which we can really assess and understand what's happening in our history. And if we can understand our history in a more comprehensive way, it'll really inform where we are now and how we move forward as a country. I think the reason why critical race theory is a real lightning rod right now is because it is really, to put it lightly, it's really evaluating our racialized society in ways that we're not used to. Certainly it has happened with the criminal justice system and has been since as we talked about earlier. But now it is being applied across many different sectors of our society. Well, what I say, different institutions. So, as you know, we just talked about my background within Christianity and working in churches, and specifically in evangelical churches. This is the hot button topic as well, and it is threatening to rip the evangelical church apart because there is such division about. Should critical race theory be talked about? Should it even be used as an analytical tool to make sense of what's happening in the church? And there's a real power struggle of sorts. And so part of what critical race theory is doing is trying to destabilize power structure.
I know the critics say it's divisive.
Yes.
They say it broadens that divide. Even.
Yes. Yes. And I think that's what should be expected whenever you're perhaps you've heard terms like this, speaking truth to power. So, and I want to be really clear here. I don't believe that entire groups of people are evil because of their ethnic, racial, and any other background. But historically, all you have to do is look at how history has unfolded globally, right? So from moving into countries, Europeans moving into countries, and then creating colonies and imperialism and how that worked. It's really clear that there's an entire ethos that comes with that, right? So the people who have been involved in it historically have been European people who have been white. Mm-hmm. But I do want to make this caveat. It should be known that early on, there was no such thing as whiteness. Right, so white was an invention, just like as critical race theorists talk about this. Race is a social construction. That's one of the tenets of critical race theory. And so, to put even finer point on this, is that even when you look at European society, if we can call it that, culture, prior to the invention of whiteness, the people that we now categorize as white were fighting each other, right? So it was certainly cultural difference that was driving it. So my take on this is the reason why it's so important in an educational setting to teach it and not to necessarily say that we're trying to create this advocacy, although some will go in that direction, is that in order to understand what is happening in American society, both past, present, and into the future, you have to understand how race plays a role. And you have to understand how hierarchy has been created, a social hierarchy has been created, sustained, and arguably will be maintained into the future unless we do something different. So critical race theory becomes the way in which that can happen most readily.
I know some newspaper columnists have been weighing in, of course, on CRT. Mm-hmm. A headline in the Evansville Courier and Press from guest columnist Kevin Coakley reads, "Teaching critical race theory is patriotic, not anti-American." He says critics should revisit the preamble to the Constitution, we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, and suggestion being that the Founding Fathers understood America was a work in progress, and critical race theory reminds us that on matters of race, that is still true, a work in progress. Mm. An opposing view is in the headline of guest columnist Christopher Rufo that schools shouldn't drag kids into racial politics. Rufo defines critical race theory as an academic discipline claiming the United States was founded on racism, oppression, and white supremacy. So two radical views there.
Yes.
Very extreme views.
Yeah, very different.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's trying to find a middle ground in all this.
Right. And so, you know, I tend to use, I like to use different terms. I mean, words have weight.
Sure.
And white supremacy is a very interesting word because it certainly has its radical side of it, right? But if we use it broadly to say that every white person is a white supremacist, right, is that what we really mean? Are we living in a white dominant society? We certainly are. And so white dominance and supremacy, some would say, Rob, you're just splitting hairs. It's purely semantics. But I do think there's a difference in the meaning, especially if we understand culturally how we think about supremacy, right? So white dominance can happen amongst an entire group of people, and it is completely unintentional, even though they've reaped the benefits of what that means for them within that society. Oftentimes, what I try to do is pretty much a lightning rod when we think about this in the American context. So what I tend to do is let's look at a society or a culture that's not our own and see how it plays itself out. South Africa is a fantastic example, right? Japan is another great example. So what I'm looking for are societies where there is a dominant group and then that also has what we would consider marginalized groups. There are fewer of those groups, of people representing those groups within that society. And then does it play the same? And the answer, staggeringly, is yes. So whoever is the dominant group within that society tends to not even think about their dominance within that society and or think about the marginalized group and the needs that they have and the struggles that they're facing in order to integrate or assimilate within that society. And so that then allows us to then come back and look at our context in a bit more critically. And so that's where I think I would not say that critical race theory is something that should be taught at all the grade levels, so to be clear. I think that is really from that middle school to high school, certainly as those critical thinking skills are being developed and strengthened and identified, that's when you want to start to be able to use this in the context of like a social studies course for sociology, anthropology, history. You want to be able to get at those details and how CRT can really help give an analytical lens by which to understand the subject matter.
We're talking to Dr. Rob Shelby. He's the Chief Diversity Officer at the University of Evansville, and you teach sociology at U of E. And I'm just curious, what's the reaction among your fellow educators to CRT?
So it also is a bit of a lightning rod. I think most sociologists, and this is something that sociologists do, right? We talk in generalizations, right? We generalize, but it doesn't mean that this is applied to every individual. Most sociologists completely understand and see that it is a viable way to be able to really critique our society. Mm-hmm. And it does come out of a sociological paradigm, theoretical paradigm. So what many people don't tend to talk about when they're talking about critical race theory, they tend to start right with that legal context for critical race theory. I go all the way back to Karl Marx, and I am not a Marxist, but I have studied Karl Marx. And what I've learned is that Marx was really famous for helping us understand that there is a hierarchy within society, to put it simply, the haves and the have-nots, and what he called the proletariat and the bourgeoisie, right? So the bourgeoisie are the people who own the means of production. He was an economist by trade, and so and then the proletariat was a working class. It would be W.E. Du Bois who would do that several years, decades later, who would then apply that to race. He saw that playing out in the American context. So it was white people who were that bourgeoisie class. They owned the means of social production, and then that quote unquote working class or the proletariat were black people. And so that is the real core of critical race theory, recognizing that there's a hierarchy. And Marx had this groundbreaking idea, perhaps, that the only way you're going to see social change is by revolution. And he believed that that revolution needed to be bloody. And I would not. That is not where I find myself. I don't believe that's the way forward. And we've seen plenty of examples where violence does not work. So I'm more aligned with the viewpoint of Dr. King, right? So the idea of nonviolent protest in ways to be able to bring about change. I think we start off with really great intentions, right? We look at the world around us and we categorize things in order to help us make sense of them, right? A rose is not a petunia. A lion is not a tiger. Now, both flowers and both big cats, but we recognize while they're a part of the same family, they are different. Well, it was just a matter of time that it was going to happen with humanity. So we start looking at, so what makes us different? And as you know, with American history, as we are also connected with our European connection there, that we started to distinguish between humanity. And it's not that the problem was we recognized that some people were lighter colored skin and others were darker and there were people in between and that there were men and women and people in between. That was not the issue. The issue is that we identified those differences and then we created a hierarchy. We said that there are people who are going to be at the top and then there are going to be people who are perhaps in the middle. To be clear, with Marx, there was no middle. There was no middle class, right? We have a middle class now economically, and it does stretch across. So we have a multi-class society that then also cuts across race, gender, so on and so forth, all those other categories. And that's what we call intersectionality, right? So that's another really big term. But CRT is really focused on that too, right? To recognize that intersectionality is a real thing that we have to understand in order to help our society function in a more welcoming way.
Now, you go to different businesses and organizations talking about the importance of diversity in the workplace.
Yes.
That's harmony, very important. Also, it's good for business.
It is. So as you started off with our conversation, it's like we're at a real important moment in diversity work within organizations. Universities have been doing this for some time. They're doing more of it now. And now businesses recognize, even nonprofits recognize the importance of diversity because if you think about from the corporate side of things, the business side of things for profit, you need to understand who your customers are, your potential customers, and those markets. From a nonprofit side, you need to think about who your clients are and who your constituents are. And so understanding diversity only helps an organization become better. Mm-hmm. I'll say the other training that I've done has been with police departments, which believe it or not, there is a lot of work that's being done in this area. And so given what has happened specifically over the past 18 to 24 months with police in communities of color, this is another huge step forward. And so what does it look like for law enforcement officers and for corrections officers to understand how diversity plays out and cultural diversity in particular plays out within their work environment? It's really necessary.
Mm-hmm. Now, if a person, I know when you go to these training sessions, if a coworker is being discriminated against or harassed or see somebody else in that situation, what's the protocol to get it corrected?
So, you know, we encourage organizations to really have a policy. And it's really nice because the federal government provides us with real clear what is definition? So what is discrimination? What is harassment? What we tend to do in higher education is we look at Title IX, so sexual harassment and discrimination, and then we apply those same principles to other protected classes, right, to make sure that we're not discriminating against a person based on religion, class, creed, so on and so forth. And so organizations should be thinking in that way. There should be someone, it's usually someone within human resources, that creates a policy and a process by which those incidents can be reported. And we also try to make them so that they can be reported anonymously, because mm-hmm. there can be repercussions. Retaliation is a real thing. And so once they've been reported, there needs to be a process for addressing them. And so in many higher education universities or institutions, we have a process by which we basically go on a fact-finding mission of sorts, right? We try to gather enough information to see if a violation has occurred. And if there has been, there are then processes by which that is addressed within the organization.
Well, my guest is Dr. Rob Shelby. He's the Chief Diversity Officer at the University of Evansville. Also a farmer. Gentleman farmer. We could talk about that. Coming up, we'll talk about the Shelby Homestead in Gibson County, which Gibson County has a rich history
of
Black American farmers
yes.
there. People living off the land, Lyle Station being
yes.
a great example of
yes.
that. A lot more to talk about. I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street, presented by Jeffrey Berger of Berger Wealth Services at Bayard Private Wealth Management. We'll be right back. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James, and if you are just joining us, my guest is Dr. Rob Shelby, sociology professor and chief diversity officer at the University of Evansville. And, you know, we're all creatures of our own environment, growing up with ingrained beliefs and biases. That's not a knock. It's just a fact. Often we don't know there's a problem dealing with diversity, but we can be trained. So that's when Dr. Shelby takes the podium. So what are some frequently asked questions at these diversity training events, Dr. Shelby?
Well, it's never been asked of me why diversity is important. So I tend to pay attention not just to the questions that are being asked. I pay attention to the questions that are not being asked.
Okay, there you go.
Because it does inform us, right?
Sure.
And one of the when that question is not asked, that means that it's assumed that it is important. And then it's a matter of, so how does this actually work? And it's in those details. So the questions are usually involving some type of a scenario, right? So a person will talk about a person who is being marginalized or within the workplace, within their organization, how do we address that as an organization, or how do we have a more diverse workforce? That one comes up a lot. And because organizations are recognizing the real importance and value of it, of diversity in particular, they want to know, so how do we become a more diverse and welcoming organization? How do we connect to people who are unlike us? And I try to address that based on context. So as I talked about before, working with the police department and the sheriff's department is different than working with a Fortune 500 or working with a nonprofit. And so the context is going to be really important in order to help them understand strategically how they're going to go about doing that. It's one thing to welcome people or to attract people. It's something else to keep them. And so the ongoing work environment is really critical because, as I've said often, you know, when we enter the workplace, we're not checking our cultural baggage at the door. We're bringing it with us, and we're trying to find a way. And for organizations that function really well, what they're doing is they have their own culture, right? So organizational culture where all of these identities, social identities, can be welcomed and they can thrive, they can contribute. And that part is what we call inclusion. So if you haven't heard me say this before, diversity to me is the easy part. Now, all of this is challenging, but diversity is easy. So we all recognize that there are differences. Then it's a matter of, okay, so how do we attract them? To me, easy. Equity, that's another challenge. It's harder to have equity than it is to have diversity. But inclusion is the most challenging, because you can have a diverse workforce, a diverse organization. You can even say that we're going to be equitable in our salaries, in our practices, in the way in which we hire. You can have equity across those things. But inclusion means that now that you have this diverse workforce and you have equitable policies and practices, how are the people who are now a part of the organization going to contribute to the organization? Whose voices are you listening to? Are there some voices that carry more weight than others? That is the messiness of this work, and that is the most challenging part of it.
Well, briefly, we want to talk about, now, you corrected me during our break. You don't live on the farm now, but you did have a farm, a homestead
yes.
in Gibson County. How did that come about?
Oh, my goodness. So, and I'll say this, too. My heart is on the farm. And this is coming from a kid who grew up in the suburbs of Chicago. You could have never told me I'd be living on a farm. This it's a fun story, and there's always a story, right?
Sure. Thank goodness.
Yeah. So when I finished my doctoral program at the University of Louisville, Trish said to me, she said, you know, Rob, it's time for us to move on. And so you made the promise several years ago that when you made this transition, we would live on a farm. And I thought, well, okay, that's not going to happen in Evansville. And I didn't know much about Evansville at the time. And so we came here after I was hired on looking for a place to live. And we struggled trying to find a home. And she said, you know, I found this place on Craigslist, and I think we should go take a look at it. It was 45 minutes north of here. And I complained the whole way driving to Gibson County. And I kid you not, as soon as we kind of drove over this, we were on a gravel road, we drove over this hill, and I saw this house sitting on the hill, and I said, that's going to be our house. And sure enough, it was. We lived on what we called it Ruby Acres Farm, named after Trisha's grandmother, who, you know, grew up on farms in Kentucky and then moved to Illinois, and a very agrarian family, right? Mm-hmm. And so here was this suburban kid, man now, trying to figure out how to live on a farm. And for anyone who knows the gateway to farming, it's chickens. And so we started off with 6 chickens, and that became 60 chickens. And we started raising, we were keeping them in order to have the eggs. And so the way that I talked about this was we had free-range, GMO-free chickens and high-quality eggs that we then sold to people here in town for people who could afford them. And those people who could afford those eggs would then supplement people who didn't have access to them. So we donated eggs every other week to Patchwork Central here in town to make sure that families who didn't have the resources to have those high-quality eggs would have them cost-free. So that was our mission.
Did you know at the time about Gibson County's heritage with Black American farmers?
I did.
Oh, you did.
Yes. So it didn't take too long to figure out. So Princeton, it was close. So I was living in Owensville, which was very close to. I was closer to Poseyville than I was to downtown, this center town of Owensville, and it didn't take long. Having to go to Princeton to Rural King and other places. You see this sign that says Lyle Station, and it's like, and I'm an inquisitive person, so it's like, what is this? And I started doing my research, and also learned with a church that I was a part of in rural Owensville, the First Christian Church there, that there were several families that a part of their family history, the Underground Railroad was a part of their family history that ran through their farms. And so I was really fascinated by that. And so, yes, a real connection to African-American Black settlements, Black pioneers in Gibson County. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, that gave me a great sense of pride and a way to be able to feel connected, like I was doing something that, my forebearers were a part of.
And then, of course, he met up with Stanley Madison.
Yes, Stanley's a
Lyle Station.
Yeah, fantastic human being.
He is.
Yes.
He's got a great museum up there at Lyle
yes.
Station. You got to check it out. Well, I tell you, we can't go on without talking about the bees.
Oh, of course.
When did you get involved with beekeeping?
Okay, so it took me a year to get involved with beekeeping because I was absolutely terrified. I wasn't afraid of bee stings. I was afraid of that I would do something to harm them.
Okay.
And I didn't want to do that. So it took me a year to do research. And the way that this happened is my dear spouse, Trish, said, one Christmas I got bee boxes for Christmas. I was completely surprised. Didn't see that coming at all. No sooner did I get the boxes, I discovered that there's a bee school that is over at Audubon, right over in Kentucky. And once or twice a year, they have training. You can come in at any level. I was a beginning beekeeper, and they took me through the full paces of how do you, keep bees? And I learned so much in that. It was a one-day training and then started. Now Gibson County has a bee club that's up there. And I learned so much from the beekeepers and doing my own independent research. And so I started off with one hive, and that moved over to two. And And then we moved to town. And so that created a really interesting dilemma. It's not a dilemma anymore. I still have my bees here in town. And so still harvesting honey, and it's such a fantastic experience.
Well, you have quite a life,
sure.
Dr. Shelby, a lot going on in your life, and I know you're very active with the diversity training going on in the entire Evansville area.
Mm-hmm.
I assume you go to outside Evansville as well?
Oh, yes. So the training we're doing with the Sheriff's Department and Corrections is in Jasper County, is in Jasper.
Okay.
So, really building some great relationships there, and going to be working with some of the other law enforcement agencies around in surrounding counties. So really looking forward to that.
Well, Dr. Shelby, this has been a fascinating conversation. I've really enjoyed talking to you. You are a bee wrangler, chicken farmer, and of course a proud family man as well.
Indeed.
Thanks for being my guest on 2 Main Street.
Thanks for having me.
I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street, presented by Jeffrey Berger of Berger Wealth Services at Bayard Private Wealth Management. Dr. Rob Shelby is leading a civil rights bus tour for local high school students. The 8-day trip will explore historical sites in the South. It's called Journey to Justice, and the high school juniors and seniors can earn 3 college credits. Among the stops on the Journey to Justice, the Rosa Parks Museum, Edmund Pettus Bridge, the National Civil Rights Institute, Beale Street, and the Breonna Taylor Memorial. Before heading out, the students will visit the Evansville African American Museum. Two Main Street airs Thursday at 1 and Saturday at 11. Presented by Jeffrey Berger of Berger Wealth Services at Bayard Private Wealth Management.